Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Jesus made the point that the poor are with us always. In today's program, we continue our series on St. Ignatius and the Jesuits and ask why Jesuits are so concerned for the needs of the poor. Also in the programme, we hear about a 19th century English priest whose lasting legacy to the poor of his native city of Liverpool lives on today. We will also hear from a Zambian obstetrician who is working to ensure that women who are poor will survive their pregnancy. First, however, we will listen to what the Pope had to say in today's general audience. Charles Collins has more.
Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on the early Christians of the Church during his weekly general audience Wednesday in the Pope Paul VI Audience Hall. The Pope spoke about the Church's first martyr, St. Stephen.
The Acts of the Apostles tells us that Stephen, a man full of faith and of Holy Spirit, was one of seven men, traditionally considered the first deacons, appointed by the apostles to assist the Greek-speaking widows in the Jerusalem community. The apostles then prayed and laid their hands on them as a sign of handing on a specific office within the community, as well as beseeching the grace necessary to fulfill it.
Pope Benedict went on to speak about the ministry of St. Stephen.
In addition to his ministry of charity, Stephen also preached the gospel, and his fearless proclamation of Jesus as a fulfillment of the Mosaic law led to his death by stoning. His martyrdom, in imitation of Christ, unleashed a local persecution, which resulted in the preaching of the gospel beyond Jerusalem and finally to the pagans. As we know, Stephen's death was witnessed by the young Saul, who after his dramatic conversion to Christ would take up and develop Stephen's preaching of the gospel as centered on faith in Christ rather than the observance of the law.
The Holy Father says that the life of St. Stephen can serve as a model for us today.
Stephen's example shows us the inseparability of faith and charity and reminds us that every persecution can become an opportunity for the spread of the gospel and the growth of the Church. Let us have the courage to take up his example of bold witness.
After the audience, the Pope greeted several groups, including some from the Focolare movement, and encouraged them to renew their commitment to spread the gospel. I'm Charles Collins.
Three very different Jesuits, but one message. We have a duty to put the needs of the poor before our own.
Well, I think we have to be faithful. First of all, to the Gospels, which teach us to be aware of the kingdom we're trying to work for, in the kingdoms of justice and peace and love. And when we're talking about justice, we just can't ignore political issues and social issues. We just can be spiritual if we are away up in the clouds. You know, the Gospels say we have to be down to earth, not belong to this world, but at the same time be in this world and trying to fix in many ways or actually help the evolution of this whole process of creation that God started.
I think it is more to do with the type of formation that we have been getting right from day one when we enter the novitiate. An option for the poor, an option to make your life meaningful so that others' lives are meaningful. And if you want to make your own life meaningful, you have to realize that there are others also who are longing to do the same. So there's a bridge somewhere We would like to identify ourselves. That's why we go during our formation period, philosophy and theology. We don't like to be staying in our own homes and our own big houses. We'd rather go and stay in chawls. We'd rather go and stay with the people. We'd rather go and stay in the slums and identify ourselves with those people. And remaining with them for a period of 3 years and 4 years, you really come to the crux of the problem. What exactly is the difficulty? In what situation these people live?
It is really the desire to be of help in whatever way possible that motivated Ignatius and continues to motivate Jesuits. And so far as our tradition has been, let me say, an intellectual one, we try to preserve this, but keeping very strongly in mind that it's not knowledge, power, or prestige, or positions in universities for their own sake, but as being platforms through which we can reach out in service to those in need.
Three very different Jesuits, but one message. We have a duty to put the needs of the poor before our own. We are called to serve others if we are serious about living a gospel way of life. Father Ernesto Travieso is a Cuban Jesuit who heads Vatican Radio's Latin America program. Father Alfie Benjamin, an Indian, leads the Vatican Radio programming for South Asia. Father Lisbeth de Souza, also an Indian, is an assistant to the Jesuit Superior General. They are three very different personalities with equally dissimilar life experiences, but they are all adamant that to be a Jesuit means working for the disadvantaged. They are merely following the example of St. Ignatius.
He insisted that even when La Inés and Salmeron were the theologians of the Pope at Trent, he wanted them to stay in a hospice. He wanted them to teach catechism to little children. So somehow, the constant reminder that no matter what position you fill or what role you have, you are supposed to be with the poor. Physically, if possible, definitely psychologically, spiritually, and mentally. So that balance, I think, is very important. And the day the society loses that, we will lose, I think, what is intrinsic to our charism of service.
The type of people who normally go to stay in the villages, in the slums, and want to identify are normally people from the average income group, you know, average income families group, sons and coming from their background, that background. So I feel it comes in very naturally with our studies, and we would like to be one with the people, to fight for their causes, to feel the causes of what they suffer. You are suffering with them.
We have to be faithful to our Ignatius of Loyola's ways. You know, Ignatius left us this incredible document of the spiritual exercises in which every human being is allowed to encounter God in his three persons or three aspects. The Father, who is a loving, protecting, loving Father, who wants us to be living in justice with one another. The Son, who came to teach us how to love and how to give ourselves for others, in whom we have to see him personally, and the Holy Spirit.
So much did Ignatius care that his followers should be aware of the needs of the poor, every Jesuit has, at the beginning of his period of formation, an experience of living totally as a beggar on the charity of others. This generates an awareness of how the world can be made a better place. Father Ernesto comments,
just can go by seeing injustice and poverty and problems and oppressions and not just being involved because Christ is there. That's our choice to the poor, which means not to work only with the poor. We have to work with the whole society, with the rich and the poor, the important people, and whoever, changing and inviting, lovingly always, never with hatred, to make a better society that we need, especially today. So Ignatius invites us, as we encounter God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, who is giving inspiration, who is giving us strength to work in this world and to make it a better world.
When we have this Rasta Roko, say, or you want to fight for the rights of the people in a big company or in our own houses, our own Jesuits have stood thick and thin with the workers, And that was an eye-opener to our superiors. He says, our own scholastics are with them. It's not the union of only the workers who are working with us in the kitchen, in the farm, and all, but our own scholastics have joined, so we need to rectify ourselves. There is something wrong somewhere, and we need to do that and check on that. And so a lot of human rights and a lot of dignity to the servant to that group came in when our own joined in. And that was one plus point when we said that we are here to identify ourselves. We have made an option for the poor. We want to be with the poor. We will remain poor, not by staying separate.
Ignatius, when he was so ill before his conversion, had found himself looking at the lives of St. Francis of Assisi and St. Dominic. He declared that whatever these saints did, he could also do. This attitude, insists Father Alfie, inspires the Jesuits of today.
Well, I think working with the poor is that. It's changing the world so it won't be so unfair, especially to the suffering. And that's the thing, social justice is part of that. I think we just can't ignore social justice if we're working for the poor people. But again, I must insist, it's not working with the poor people only. It's working with all members of society to be aware that we have to take care of one another, be fair with one another, create structures that are not dehumanizing, but again, making the world a better place to live.
You get people from all different strata of society, get people from all different regions, and each one comes and expresses himself. So a ray of hope comes. He says, I have done this in my past, and this is how I've achieved, and I've done something good. So it becomes a sort of here we have a model. He has done this, and I would like to do the same.
Which is very much what Ignatius did
right through. He says, if those saints could do it, why not me? I can also do the same. So that sort of a thing sometimes keeps lurking behind us, especially when we live in small groups. We call them like-minded groups, live-in groups, where they are from different states and different societies, from different backgrounds, and that is what where we get a little inspired. If he can do it, if he has been successful, I would like to do the same. Let's form a group together and fight this cause together.
He's one of many uncanonized saints, Father James Nugent, who lived and died working for the poor people of his native Liverpool.
He was born in Liverpool in 1822 and died again in Liverpool in 1905. And he was a very well-respected man in Liverpool. If I tell you that from the church where his funeral mass was said in the centre of Liverpool to Ford Cemetery where he was buried is a journey of 5 miles, and it was lined all the way, several people deep in some parts, by people wishing to pay their respects. And that ahead of him were several bands, and all the flags in Liverpool were flown at half-mast, and there were several thousand people actually at the cemetery to witness the burial. I think that will give you some idea of the regard with which he was held in Liverpool at that time.
Everyone who passes through Liverpool city centre will be familiar with St. John's Gardens and a cloaked figure of a priest, protecting an orphan child under one arm and blessing another child with his other hand.
He was needed very much in this country because in the middle of the 19th century, as I'm sure people are aware, there were a succession of potato failures. The crop was failed in Ireland, and people came over from Ireland, and Liverpool being the nearest port in England, they tended to come through the port here. So that, for instance, in April 1847, it was recorded locally that upwards of 90,000 poor Irish had arrived in the port since the beginning of the year. So that's 90,000 people just in the first 4 months of the year, at a time when the population of Liverpool was about 223,000. So it was a tremendous influx of people, and they had to cram into cellars, attics, multi-occupied dwellings near the docks in very insanitary conditions. And as a result, there were a great many fever outbreaks of cholera and typhus. And as a result, in 1847, Liverpool had the very first medical officer of health. Very many people died, some 15,000 in 1 year, which is a terrific number of people. And James Nugent was asked to come to Liverpool after several priests had died. There were 24 priests in Liverpool at that time, with 8 Catholic chapels. And out of those 24 priests, 10 died. 8 were ill and then recovered. And this was because they needed to visit the dying in their very overcrowded accommodation, sometimes lifting the dead into the coffins themselves. And as a result, they contracted fever and died. And they're known as the 10 Martyr Priests of Liverpool.
At a time when some people made huge fortunes from the shipping for which the port of Liverpool was world famous, there was also tremendous hardship.
A few years later, it was reckoned that there were a great many children living homeless on the streets. In 1850, it was estimated there were 20,000 children living rough, which is an enormous number, particularly when you think that the Victorians regarded a child as somebody under 8. So there were a lot of children. Some had been left there by their parents who had gone on to other parts of England to get jobs, but never came back for the children. Some of them were the orphans of people who had died in the fevers. So there were a great many children wandering the street. Father Nugent was very concerned about the care of these children. He talked about the talent that was running to waste in the gutters of the city. And he was instrumental in getting what was called a town meeting, a public meeting in 1854 with Save the Child as the slogan. And that was held at the town hall. And on the platform was not just himself, but also representatives of the Anglican, Methodist, Baptist and Unitarian churches, and even apparently the head of the local Orange Lodge. And following a further meeting at St George's Hall, they had a children's charter drawn up in which they all agreed to do what they could to overcome poverty of the homeless children.
It must be remembered that at the same time as the Irish flooded into Liverpool as the result of the potato famines, so also many Welsh mining families left the slavery of the coal mines and tried to make a new life in Liverpool. The result of the huge influx into the city was appalling poverty. Father Nugent was practical in his approach, continuing even when those whom he tried to help attempted to destroy their very means of survival.
Father Nugent opened a night refuge to give shelter to boys who had nowhere to sleep. But as the years went on, he became involved in other areas of work. He became chaplain to Walton Jail. He also, because of the number of youngsters, as you say, who got into mischief, became involved in the reformatory movement and started with a nautical training ship, which was called the HMS Clarence, and it was moored off Rock Ferry, the other side of the river from Liverpool. He'd obtained this on loan from the Admiralty in 1864. But in 1884, a number of boys set fire to it and destroyed it. So after quite a bit of haggling with the insurance and the Admiralty, he obtained another ship, which was also then named the Clarence. And that lasted till the 1890s, when, again, it was burnt down by some of the boys who had managed to smuggle oily waste onto the ship and set fire to it while the Bishop of Shrewsbury was on board. Everybody was saved on both occasions.
Father Nugent also considered those boys who were not strong enough to be trained for the Navy.
So in 1872, he founded a farm school at Birkdale. But it wasn't so easy to find employment for the boys who were trained at the farm school as it was for those who were trained for the Navy on the training ship. So Father Nugent took some of them over to Canada. He went with them himself and found employment for them on farms in Canada. And that was the beginning of a movement to place some children over in Canada. I mean, I think we might see it as quite harsh, sending children abroad, but there were a great many people who did go abroad at that period, and it was seen as an opportunity for a new life.
Women and girls weren't forgotten.
Because of his work at Walton Jail, he became concerned about the welfare of the female ex-prisoners. So this led to the establishment of a night shelter run by the Poor Servants of the Mother of God in 1891, by which time he was actually 70. In 1897, he'd persuaded the Sisters of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary to open accommodation for mothers and their illegitimate babies. And then in 1904, a year before his death, another home for pregnant women was established as well. So he had concern for people in all walks of life, really.
Catholic education in Liverpool was also the result of Father Nugent's unrelenting hard work and his concern for children.
When he was a boy, because there were no Catholic schools at all in Liverpool, he actually went to a private academy, which was run by an Anglican clergyman. But he was instrumental in setting up schools. It wasn't compulsory for children to go to school at that stage, but he founded a school for boys in Liverpool, originally for boys, and that was successful. And gradually developed. He was very keen that children should be educated, because when he was in Walton Prison, he did a little survey of how many of the Catholic prisoners could read and write and was appalled to find the low state of literacy. And so he was very keen that this should happen, particularly when one of the prisoners said to him that he was more or less too late to save them. He should start with the youngsters, and so if they were educated and had good jobs, they wouldn't end up in prison like he had.
Father Nugent might have died many years ago, but his inspiration has its ongoing influence in Liverpool today.
Today, I think we still try and carry on his work. And we consider that, as well as being a service provider for vulnerable people, we're also a society that campaigns for social justice. And we provide establishments for residential establishments for people with different difficulties that they're experiencing in life, whether they're children or adults, and also community services for vulnerable people. I think we're all always very mindful of what Father Nugent would say. And if he found a need, he would find some way of seeing that need was met. And I think this is where we either campaign to see that a local authority provides a service, or we will ourselves see if we can provide that service.
My thanks to Ruth Christie at the Nugent Care Centre in Liverpool. Now we hear from a Zambian obstetrician who is working daily with the poor to try to reduce maternal mortality.
Maternal mortality, meaning that a woman who is pregnant dies either because of the pregnancy itself or the birth, or even after birth within the 42 days after that delivery, we call that a maternal death. And it is a statistic as a part of the maternal mortality ratio or rate.
It is a sad fact throughout the world that some women, once they become pregnant, will not survive the pregnancy. From the beginning of time, having a baby has been a risky process. Dr. Griselda Mukumba, a consultant obstetrician from the University Teaching Hospital in Lusaka, Zambia, lists some of the reasons for maternal death.
Now, for us here, we have problems of hemorrhage. They are either before the delivery, they bleed, or after the delivery, they bleed so much as to end up shocked and they die. And another group of patients will die because of the hypertension. The blood pressure goes up very significantly and they get the complications of that blood pressure. Some of them is because either they have delivered at home where the asepsis is not so common. Asepsis meaning that you avoid infection. But if they can't avoid that infection, you find they become very septic, infected. And by the time they come to the hospital, they are already gasping and they die. Others would have the medical conditions, of course, including the present HIV, which may actually just worsen the previous conditions. So this is what we see at the moment in our situation.
The Millennium Development Goals list as one of their objectives the halving of maternal mortality by the year 2015. But Dr. Makumba notes a startling fact.
England and Sweden, they also had such high maternal mortality years ago. But then suddenly, all this dropped very dramatically. Within 2-3 years, they saw a dramatic drop in maternal deaths. And it was difficult for them to pinpoint as to what the real cause of that drop in the maternal mortality was. Was it the antibiotics? Was it the blood transfusion? Was it a contraception that was, etc.? But what they actually found out was that the socio-economic situation of the people improved very well.
The poor and less educated are especially vulnerable. Very often they are looked down on by the very people who are meant to help them.
You'll find most of the women in the poor areas, they will hesitate to actually seek for that care. There are different reasons for them to, let's say, avoid going to anybody to ask for help. One of them is that probably they don't actually know that these are danger signs. They have noticed something is wrong, but they just want to wait. Or they don't know where to go and get that help. Even when they know where to go and get that help, perhaps the attitude of the nurses just puts them off, or the attitude of any health worker puts them off. And so they would rather prefer to die in the house. And if they know that at the next level, they are not going to find any help because there is no needle, there is no drug, there is only one midwife there and nobody else, they might as well just remain at home. So they delay in seeking this help that is there.
Education alone does not provide sufficient answers to the problems of maternal mortality. There is also an urgent need for resources.
We can sensitize the people in the community. And when they come to us and we have nothing to offer them, then we have a problem.
So what is the answer? Dr. Makumba concludes.
I would say, as long as there is poverty, illiteracy, low status of women, poor sanitation, nutrition, poor transportation, inadequate medical services, indifference in the policy maker, maternal mortality will continue to rise. Then there is need to stop talking and start intervening.
And so we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again, in whole or in its parts, if you go to our website at vaticanradio.org and click on English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.